The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm filling in for George Douglas this week and probably next week as well. But for the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Today we're reading from the Week magazine dated February 1st, 2013. And we'll be reading, first of all, the main stories, then controversy of the week, then good week four, bad week four, then the people section, the briefing section, the best columns in the U.S. section, the last word, and ending up with talking points, and maybe notes and poll watch if we have enough time. But first, the main stories. Obama's audacious second-term agenda. What happened? President Obama launched his second term as president this week with a full-throated defense of progressive government, insisting in his inaugural address that, quote-unquote, preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. Obama took the oath of office before a crowd of 700,000 people on the National Mall on Monday, before delivering a fiery speech in which he called for immigration reform, action to slow climate change, and full recognition of the equality of gays and lesbians. In a rebuke to Republicans, Obama said, the country could not afford to get bogged down in, quote-unquote, centuries-old debates about the role of government, but needed to act promptly to address its problems and expand opportunity. Obama insisted that deficit reduction did not justify deep cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, saying these safety net programs do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. Republicans said they were affronted by the aggressive tone of the speech, which they called unduly partisan. The era of liberalism is back, said Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky. If the president pursues that kind of agenda, obviously it's not designed to bring us together, what the editorial said. This speech was the coming out party for the real Obama, said the San Jose Mercury News. The president finally affirmed his belief in activist government as a force for good, rooted firmly in America's founding philosophies. He promised to continue the never-finished task of ensuring that all of us, including the poor, immigrants, gays, and lesbians, women, have the opportunity to realize our dreams. With this audacious and eloquent speech, said the New York Times, Obama proved he has the ambition and intellect to place himself in the first rank of presidents. Great presidents bring Americans together, not divide them, said the Wall Street Journal. Obama's takers reference was a cheap shot against Republicans, and his nakedly liberal rhetoric made it clear that he'll continue to demean and stigmatize those who disagree with him. Words alone do not make for a presidential greatness, says NationalReview.com. After 4 years of ever-expanding government, swelling deficits, and wealth redistribution, the rhetoric is still soaring and the country is still stagnating. That's the real Obama. What the columnist said. Obama's goal is now clear, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. He hopes to use the next 4 years to achieve presidential greatness, becoming a transformative president on the scale of Lincoln, FDR, and Reagan. In this, he will almost certainly fail. As the first African-American president, Obama is guaranteed a place in history. But his main legislative achievement, Obamacare, may yet backfire, and he's shown no leadership on the great crisis of our age, the exploding deficit. Even so, Obama sees himself as Lincoln's heir, said Mona Charon in NationalReview.com. He chose to take his oath on Honest Abe's Bible and poached phrases and ideas from Lincoln's speeches. But whereas Abe was humble and inspirational, offering charity to all, even during the Civil War, Obama preens and struts like a triumphant conqueror. He doesn't even understand Lincoln's greatness, far less partake of it. He may not be Lincoln, said Ezra Klein in Bloomberg.com, but Obama has achieved more in his first term than most presidents secure in two, despite relentless Republican obstructionism. His universal health care law is the most significant piece of social policy passed since the Great Society, and his bailouts of Wall Street and Detroit staved off a second Great Depression. He ended the war in Iraq, is pulling us out of Afghanistan, and has already reduced the deficit by $3 trillion over the next decade. If Republicans act responsibly, Obama may achieve even more in terms of two. In his second term, said David Moranis on the Washington Post, Obama will be a changed man. The past 4 years have toughened him, and the Newtown, Connecticut shootings affected him profoundly, leaving him with a deep sense of remorse that he had ignored gun control out of political expediency. Since then, he has shown more passion and resolve. That passion will not ensure success, let alone greatness, but in his next 4 years, the once enigmatic Obama will pursue his idealistic goals forcefully and show people who he really is. That brings us to Controversy of the Week, and this week it's entitled, The GOP Searching for a Viable New Identity. Sometimes a tactical retreat is the smart play, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. After a closed-door strategy session in rural Virginia last weekend, Republican House members sensibly dropped their threat to force the federal government to default on its debt unless President Obama agreed to cuts in U.S. entitlement programs. Instead, Republicans decided to suspend enforcement of the debt limit for 3 months, giving them time to negotiate with Obama over spending cuts and entitlement reform. Retracting the debt limit threat was the right move, said Jake Sherman in Politico.com, but it forces the party to face an, quote-unquote, existential question. What does it mean to be a Republican during a second Obama term? If all our political warfare is now off the table, how do Republicans advance their agenda in a town where they have just a sliver of control? They can't, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Let's face it, the country chose Obama, and with Democrats also controlling the Senate, you cannot govern from the House. The Republicans' recent attempts to bend Obama to their will through cliffhanging brinksmanship have not only failed to work, but so alienated the public that the latest polls show the GOP ranking somewhere below head lice and colonoscopies in popularity. For the next few years, Republicans should go small, put up what's reasonable opposition they can to the worst excesses of Obama's agenda, and let him make a huge, reckless mess. Don't immolate yourself trying to save liberalism from itself. When Democrats inevitably overreach, Republicans can make a comeback in the 2014 midterms and the 2016 presidential election. Paradoxically, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com, letting Obama have his way will expose him for what he is. The president's refusal to make any tough choices and cut spending will be that much more apparent when he can no longer point and say, "Hey, look over there, House Republicans want to blow stuff up." "Just one problem," said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMagazine.com. "Many House Republicans actually are wackos. The far-right fanatics who dominate the GOP caucus represent deeply conservative, gerrymandered districts, and they aren't interested in sensible compromises on spending and taxes. In 2011, let's remember, this crowd spit on Obama's grand bargain offer to cut the deficit over 10 years by $4 trillion. If their behavior in the last Congress is any guide," said Chris Sevilla in WashingtonPost.com, "there is still a significant group within the House GOP who prize moral victories over actual victories. For them, paralysis and continuing crises may be preferable to letting Obama have his way, even if it hurts the GOP brand." "Let's not waste more time on losing battles," said William Kristol in WeeklyStandard.com. "Freed from the messy responsibility of having to govern, Republicans now have the liberating opportunity to rebuild their reputations as the thrifty, responsible stewards of the public purse, while using every opportunity to tell voters that unless we dramatically cut spending, our nation is headed for a calamitous fiscal reckoning." To regain power in Washington, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com, Republicans need to broaden their appeal to independents, and that starts with rejecting the base's obsession with ideological purity. The party hasn't been marginalized because it's insufficiently conservative. The real problem is that the GOP isn't tactfully smart or persuasive enough to move the rest of the nation in a more conservative direction. Until we figure out how to do that, Democrats will be calling the shots. And that takes us to the section called Good Week 4, Bad Week 4. Well, it seems like it was a good week for Freudian slips after Vice President Joe Biden told in his inauguration party in Iowa that "I'm proud to be President of the United States," triggering new speculation that he does plan to run in 2016. Good week for sibling rivalry after John and Jim Harbaugh led their respective teams, the Baltimore Ravens and the San Francisco 49ers, to victory in conference championship games, setting up the first brother-versus-brother coaching matchup in Super Bowl history. And finally, it's been a good week for frying up some fish and chips after four large barrel-shaped chunks of lard from World War II washed up on a beach in northern Scotland. The animal fat, which is thought to have come from a sunken cargo ship, still looks and smells good enough to have a fry-up with, said a local. And then it's been a bad week for Beyoncé after it was revealed that the pop siren lip-synced the Star-Spangled Banner at President Obama's inauguration. A spokesman for the U.S. Marine Corps band expressed surprise that Beyoncé used a recording, since we all know she has the pipes. And it was a bad week for Subway after it was discovered that many of the sandwich chain's foot-long subs are, in fact, only 11 to 11.5 inches long. Subway said the name footlong was not intended to be a measurement of length. And finally, it's been a bad week for respecting your elders after Japan's finance minister, Taro Aso, said that the elderly should hurry up and die to help out the country's soaring health care costs. The 72-year-old added that he would refuse end-of-life care and plan to, quote-unquote, die quickly. Is to the section of the program called People. The first one is Why McKellen Came Out. Ian McKellen spent much of his life in the closet, said Bob Flynn in the Daily Mail, UK. Although the Lord of the Rings actor is now a proud gay activist, he's raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for AIDS hospices, he didn't come out till he was 49, fearing it would ruin his career. Even now, there are young actors who want careers as romantic leading men, and the best thing is not to reveal you're gay, said McKellen. 73. I suppose I used to wonder if I'd be allowed to play Romeo if I came out. Growing up in England in the years after World War II, McKellen faced tremendous pressure to pretend that he was straight. There were no gay clubs about, no bars. Homosexuals were shamed publicly and imprisoned. You were on your own, looking over your shoulder all the time. The theater was one of the few gay-friendly environments. It's probably one of the reasons I became an actor. I'd heard you could meet queers, so it proved. Fed up with living a lie, McKellen finally announced that he was gay during a 1988 BBC interview. I thought if you have to compromise to the extent of lying about yourself, is there any job in the world that's worth that? I don't think there is. The ultimate thrill seeker, Toshifumi Fujimoto, likes to take his vacation in war zone, said Agence France-Presse. The Japanese trucker is a war tourist. He was in Yemen last year when violent demonstrations raged outside the U.S. embassy and traveled to Cairo during the Arab Spring uprising. For his latest trip, he decided to visit the war-torn Syrian city of Aleppo. It's very exciting, and the adrenaline rush is like no other, said Fujimoto, who's been hanging out with rebel fighters on the front line. Even though Aleppo has seen some of the most vicious fighting on the Syrian front, he refuses to wear a helmet or flak jacket. I'm not a target for snipers because I'm a tourist, not like you, journalist. Besides, I'm not afraid that they might kill me. I'm a combination of samurai and kamikaze. These extreme vacations offer an escape from the boring, lonely life that divorced Fujimoto leads back home in Japan. I have no family, no friends, no girlfriend. He does have three daughters whom he hasn't seen in 5 years, not even on Facebook or the Internet, nothing. That saddens me deeply. Before setting off for Syria, Fujimoto bought a life insurance policy. I pray every day that if something happens to me, my girls might collect the insurance money and be able to live comfortably. Finally, Fox's religious fervor. Megan Fox knows what it's like to be filled with the Holy Spirit, said Stephen March in Esquire. The sultry actress, 26, started speaking in tongues at age 8 when she attended a Pentecostal church in Tennessee. It feels like a lot of energy coming through the top of your head. I'm going to sound like such a lunatic. And then your whole body is filled with this electric current, she says, and you just can't stop speaking, but you're not thinking because you have no idea what you're saying. Words are coming out of your mouth and you can't control it. The idea is that it's a language only God understands. It's the language that is spoken in heaven. Fox is now a member of the non-denominational church, which she says offers her a refuge from the madness of Hollywood. I can't stand pills. I don't like drinking. I don't like feeling out of control, she explains. I have to feel like I'm in control of my body, and I know what you're thinking. Then why would I go to a church and speak in tongues? You have to understand, there I feel safe. I was raised to believe that you're safe in God's hands, but I don't feel safe with myself. That brings us to the briefing section. Today's briefing section is titled Shaped by Vietnam. Chuck Hagel, Obama's choice for defense secretary, is a decorated veteran with a deep suspicion of war. What is Hegel's background? He comes from humble stock, born in Nebraska. Hegel grew up poor and constantly on the move. His father was a World War II veteran who had bad health and drinking problem, and died when Hegel was 16. The eldest of four boys, Hegel worked to help support the family and took an early interest in politics. In 1960, he broke with his fellow Catholic schoolboys to support Richard Nixon over John F. Kennedy. Hegel was a promising high school athlete, but a neck injury forced him to give up college football scholarship. He drifted until his number came up in the draft in January of 1967. Where did he serve? Hegel initially received orders to go to Germany, but he asked for a transfer to Vietnam so he could fight in the war. Against protocol, he was placed in the same infantry squad as his younger brother Tom. Just 4 months into his tour, Hegel was caught in a mine blast, taking shrapnel wounds to his chest that his brother bandaged up. A month later, in April 1968, Hegel returned the favor after their troop carrier hit another mine. Hegel pulled Tom from the burning vehicle under heavy fire, sustaining serious burns to his face. Hegel's wounds in the two incidents won him 2 Purple Hearts. In 2007, he recalled what went through his head when rescuing his brother. "I told myself, if I ever get out of this and I'm ever in a position to influence policy, I will do everything I can to avoid needless, senseless war." So how did he get into politics? John Y. McAllister, a Nebraska congressman, brought the young veteran to Washington in the early 1970s. Within 18 months, he was McAllister's chief of staff. Hegel's ascent in the Republican Party was similarly rapid, and soon after Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, he was named deputy director of the Veterans Administration. But within 6 months, he quit in protest against cuts in benefits for his fellow Vietnam veterans. It was his first act of rebellion against the party, but far from his last. "He thinks with the clarity of an actuary," said Michael McCarthy, one of Hegel's longtime financial backers, "but decides with the heart of an Irishman." What was his next move? He sold his car and joined two friends in investing in an industry no one knew about in 1982, a cell phone company. It made him millions when it later went public. In 1992, he moved his family from Virginia back to his native Nebraska, where he was elected senator in 1996 in an upset victory after a high-profile endorsement from fellow Vietnam vet Senator John McCain. But Hegel remained a party maverick. After the GOP's poor showing in the 1998 midterm elections, he extricated the leadership for running issueless campaigns and demonizing ads. In the 2000 primaries, he backed his friend McCain, saying that George W. Bush had sold his soul to the right wing. 2 years later, he became an ever bigger burr in Bush's saddle. What issue divided them? The war in Iraq, which Hegel opposed from the get-go, earning him a place on the Axis of Appeasement, compiled by the neocon magazine The Weekly Standard. In 2002, Hegel delivered a thunderous speech on the Senate floor, warning that imposing democracy through force is a roll of the dice. The U.S., he said, did not truly understand the factional divisions among Iraqis, Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds. He then voted to authorize military action in Iraq, a vote he attributed to his loyalty to the office of the presidency. As the war spun out of control, Hegel became an ever fiercer critic of the Bush administration. He voted against extending the Patriot Act in 2005 and led opposition in the Senate to the Iraq surge of 2007, calling it the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in the country since Vietnam. Is that why many Republicans now oppose him? Hegel's apostasy on Iraq is just one of the ways in which he has infuriated his party's hawks. He has opposed military action to stop Iran's nuclear program and described the Defense Department as bloated. He angered pro-Israeli Republicans by complaining about the power of Washington's Jewish lobby and alienated social conservatives by comparing them to know-nothings. But arguably his greatest sin against the GOP was befriending Obama. The two bonded in the Senate over their contrarian views on Iraq. In 2008, Hagel declined to endorse John McCain, which brought a chill to the long friendship between the two Vietnam vets. Hagel did not endorse Obama either, but enraged McCain by traveling to Iraq with a Democratic presidential candidate in July of 2008. Hagel retired from the Senate in 2009, but he will soon return there as Obama's nominee for defense secretary to deface confirmation hearings headed by his spurned former ally. "The friendship, I hope, is still there," McCain said in January, "but I have very serious questions about whether he will serve in a way that I think serves America's best national interests." The smoking gun on Vietnam. Although the Vietnam War left Hagel scarred for decades, he saw it as a righteous cause gone wrong, not an unjustified incursion. That changed in 1997 when the government released tapes from 1964 of Lyndon B. Johnson's confessing that the U.S. could not win in Vietnam. Johnson had made a cold political calculation to stay in Vietnam to secure his legacy, Hagel came to believe, and he vowed to never, ever remain silent when that kind of thinking put more American lives at risk in any conflict. His anti-war views hardened yet further in 2005 when a cousin unearthed long-lost letters his father had written to his family during his service in the Pacific. Quote, unquote, "If I thought I would ever have a son who would have to go through this," he had written, "I would never have gotten married." And that brings us to the section of the program called Best Columns, the U.S. And we have these three. "Isolationism Won't Be Possible" by Frieda Gittes, CNN.com. The second one is "Why America Is Last in Health" by Robert Samuelson, The Washington Post. And the final one is "The Rise of Sandy Hook Truthers" by David Weigel in Slate.com. So we start with "Isolationism Won't Be Possible." Despite President Obama's most fervent wishes, the world will not be ignored, said Frieda Gittes. In his inaugural address this week, Obama laid out an agenda for the next 4 years that was almost entirely domestic, with but one scant minute devoted to foreign affairs, some self-congratulation about withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, and a vow to spread peace. He will find, whether he likes it or not, that the U.S. cannot ignore involvement in a host of crises abroad. Syria is currently unraveling, with 60,000 already dead, and Islamist extremists are taking a lead role in that opposition. With a worst-case scenario distinctly possible, Obama will not be able to endlessly ignore this dangerous war. In Egypt, the new Islamist regime may reverse the move towards democracy, while in Iran, the mullahs continue to pursue their nuclear program. Increasingly audacious al-Qaeda offshoots now pose a major threat in North Africa. China and Japan are making threats over disputed islands, and don't forget the black swans, catastrophic events no one can predict. As Obama will discover soon enough, international disengagement is not an option. Then we go to "Why America Is Last in Health." "Being American is bad for your health," said Robert Samuelson. That's the sobering conclusion of an exhaustive new report comparing our health with those of people in 16 other advanced countries. We rank at or near the bottom from life expectancy at birth to frequency of death before age 50, and it's only partly the fault of our health care system. The freedom and autonomy that are intrinsic to our culture lead us to make choices that are distinctly unhealthy and even fatal. Among males under 50, there are comparatively more homicides, often gun-related, car accidents, often alcohol-related, and other accidents, often drug-related. Bad diets, don't tell me what to eat, fuel high costs, high rates of diabetes and heart disease. American girls ages 15 to 19 get pregnant at 3.5 times the average rate of other advanced countries, producing children doomed to poverty and poor health care. Even the well-to-do suffer from stress-related disease that's a byproduct of the nation's relentlessly competitive spirit. Blinded by optimism, Americans assume we're healthier than everyone in the world. We think we're number one, even if we aren't. And finally, the rise of Sandy Hook truthers. A sickening new conspiracy theory is now spreading across the internet, said David Weigel. Gun enthusiasts have spawned a truther, that's quote-unquote truther movement, that insists the shooting of 26 people at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, was an elaborate conspiracy staged by the government to set the stage for the mass disarming of the American people. More than 10 million people have now watched a YouTube video purporting to show evidence that the murdered children's parents and the witnesses are actors, and that some of the murdered children are still alive. It may seem unhinged, but gun massacre truism isn't new. It also dribbled out after both the Aurora and Virginia Tech shootings. The paranoia at the heart of this movement is fueled by the National Rifle Association, whose executive vice president, Wayne LaPierre, boosted gun sales over the past year by warning of a quote-unquote massive Obama conspiracy to destroy the Second Amendment after the election. When a gun massacre occurred followed by Obama's sweeping gun control proposal, it fed into the NRA's darkest fears. Now its extremist core is peddling a full-on conspiracy theory. That brings us to the portion of the program called The Last Word. This week's Last Word is an article entitled, Why I Own Guns. Most gun control advocates, says Sam Harris, don't understand why rational people choose to arm themselves. Fantasists and zealots can be found on both sides of the debate over guns in America. Many gun rights advocates reject even the most sensible restrictions on the sale of weapons to the public. And proponents of stricter gun laws are often unable to understand why a good person would ever want ready access to a loaded firearm. Between these two extremes, we must find grounds for a rational discussion about the problems of gun violence. Unlike most Americans, I stand on both sides of the debate. I understand the apprehension that many people feel towards gun culture, and I share their outrage over the political influence of the National Rifle Association. How is it that we live in a society in which one of the most compelling interests is gun ownership? Where is the science lobby, the safe food lobby? Where is the get the Chinese lead paint out of our kids' toys lobby? When viewed from any other civilized society on earth, the primacy of guns in American life seems to be a symptom of collective psychosis. Most of my friends do not own guns and never will. When asked to consider the possibility of keeping firearms for protection, they worry that the mere presence of them in their homes would put themselves and their families in danger. Can't a gun go off by accident? Wouldn't it be more likely to be used against them in an altercation with a criminal? I am surrounded by otherwise intelligent people who imagine that the ability to dial 911 is all the protection against violence a sane person ever needs. But, unlike my friends, I own several guns and train with them regularly. The reason for this is simple. I have always wanted to be able to protect myself and my family, and I have never had any illusions about how quickly the police can respond when called. If a person enters your home for the purpose of harming you, you cannot expect the police to arrive in time to stop him. This is not the fault of the police, it is a problem of physics. In my view, only someone who doesn't understand violence could wish for a world without guns. A world without guns is one in which the most aggressive men can do more or less anything they want. It is a world in which a man with a knife can rape and murder a woman in the presence of a dozen witnesses, and none will find the courage to intervene. A world without guns is a world in which no man, not even a member of SEAL Team 6, can expect to prevail over more than one attacker at a time. A world without guns, therefore, is one in which the advantage of youth, size, strength, aggression, and sheer numbers are almost always decisive. Of course, owning a gun is not a responsibility that everyone should assume. Most guns kept in the home will never be used for self-defense. They are, in fact, more likely to be used by an unstable person to threaten family members or to commit suicide. However, there is nothing irrational about judging oneself to be psychologically stable and fully committed to the safe handling and ethical use of firearms, if indeed one is. An ethical argument against gun ownership must deal with the hard case, where a responsible owner of a gun winds up protecting herself and her family when only a gun would avail. Such cases exist, and their importance is not canceled by the bad things that happen when the wrong people, criminals, children, and the mentally unstable, come into possession of guns. Needless to say, we should do everything we can to keep guns out of the hands of people who will use them irresponsibly, but there are already 300 million guns in the United States, and no one appears to have a plan for reducing this number. Unless we're going to institute a $150 billion buyback of existing weapons and make the penalty for possessing an illegal gun so onerous that no sane person would do it, will remain trivially easy for career criminals to acquire guns in this country. 55 million kids went to school on the day that 20 were massacred at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. So the chances of a child's dying in a school shooting are remote. 70 mass shootings have occurred in the U.S. since 1982, leaving 543 dead. These crimes were horrific, but 564,452 other homicides took place in the U.S. during that same time period. Mass shootings scarcely represent 0.1% of all murders. One problem with liberal dreams of gun control is that the kinds of guns used in the majority of crimes would not fall under any plausible weapons ban. Advocates of stricter gun laws who claim to respect the rights of sportsmen or hunters and to recognize a legitimate need for home defense simply give the game away at the outset. The very guns that law-abiding citizens use for recreation or home defense are, in fact, the problem. In the vast majority of murders committed with firearms, even most mass killings, the weapon used is a handgun. Unless we outlaw and begin confiscating handguns, the weapons best suited for being carried undetected into a classroom, movie theater, restaurant, or shopping mall for the purpose of committing mass murder will remain readily available in the U.S. No one is seriously proposing that we address the problem on this level. In fact, the Supreme Court has recently ruled twice in 2008 and 2010 that banning handguns would be unconstitutional. Nor is anyone advocating that we deprive hunters of their rifles. Yet any rifle suitable for killing deer will allow even an unskilled shooter to wreak havoc upon innocent men, women, and children at a range of several hundred yards. The problem, therefore, is that with respect to either factor, that makes a gun suitable for mass murder, ease of concealment, a handgun, or range, a rifle, the most common and least stigmatized weapons are among the most dangerous. I support all of the reforms that gun control advocates are calling for: universal background checks, better mental health screening, a national registry, limited capacity magazines, a ban on assault weapons, checks against the terrorist watch list, etc. But they will do very little to prevent the next Newtown. We could make a gun license as difficult to get as a pilot's license, requiring dozens of hours of training. I would certainly be happy to see a policy change of this kind, but I am under no illusion that such restrictions would make it difficult for the wrong people to acquire guns illegally. I see only two options with respect to keeping our schools safe. One, we can admit that school shootings are extraordinarily rare events, hope they remain so, and then do nothing apart from implementing the above reforms. Or, number two, we can decide that these events, however rare, are simply intolerable to us, and we can spend the $10 billion or so it would cost each year to put a police officer in every school. There's no guarantee, of course, that option two would be effective, but those who think that it is obviously a bad idea, beyond its cost, seem to suffer from many misconceptions about guns and violence. Gun control advocates often fail to distinguish situations in which a gun in the hands of a good person would be useless or worse, and those in which it would be likely to save dozens of innocent lives. They are eager to extrapolate from the Aurora shooting to every other possible scene of mass murder. However, a single gunman trying to force his way into a school, or roaming its hallways, or even standing in a classroom surrounded by dead and dying children, would be far easier to engage effectively with a gun than James Holmes would have been in a dark and crowded movie theater. Even in the case of the Aurora shooting, it is not ludicrous to suppose that everyone might have been better off had a well-trained person with a gun been at the scene. The fact that bystanders do occasionally get shot, even by police officers, does not prove that putting guns in the hands of good people would be a bad idea. As the parent of a daughter in preschool, I can scarcely imagine the feelings of terror, helplessness, and grief endured by the parents of Newtown. But when I contemplate atrocities of this kind, I do not think of gun control, because it seems extraordinarily unlikely that a deranged and/or evil person will ever find it difficult to acquire a firearm in the U.S. Rather, I think of how differently the situation might have evolved if the school had had an armed, and I have to emphasize, well-trained security guard on campus. I also think of how differently things might have gone if the shooter, who seems to have shown signs of mental illness for years, had more intrusively engaged by society prior to the attack. I do not know how we can solve the problem of gun violence. A renewed ban on assault weapons will do very little to make our society safer. It seems likely to be a symbolic step that delays real thinking about the problem of guns for another decade or more. By all means, let us ban these weapons, but when the next lunatic arrives at a school armed with legal pistols and a dozen 10-round magazines, we should be prepared to talk about how an assault weapons ban was a distraction from the real issue of gun violence. I have said nothing here about what might cause a person like Adam Lanza to enter a school for the purpose of slaughtering innocent children. Clearly, we need more resources in the areas of childhood and teenage mental health, and we need protocols for parents, teachers, and fellow students to follow when a young man in their midst begins to worry them. In the majority of cases, someone planning a public assassination or a mass murder will communicate his intentions to others in advance of the crime. People need to feel personally responsible for acting on this information, and the authorities must be able to do something once the information gets passed along. But any law that allows us to commit or imprison people on the basis of a mere perception of risk would guarantee that large numbers of innocent people will be held against their will. More than new laws, I believe we need a general shift in our attitudes towards public violence, wherein everyone begins to assume some responsibility for containing it. It is worth noting that this shift has already occurred in one area of our lives, without anyone having received special training and even agreeing that a change in attitude was necessary. Just imagine how a few men with box cutters would now be greeted by their fellow passengers at 30,000 feet. Perhaps we can find the same resolve on the ground. Next week, a response to this argument from Sean Faircloth, the author and former state legislator. And that takes us to the section of the program called Talking Points. And we have this article, Manti Te'o, The Case of the Fake Girlfriend. The story was heartbreaking and inspirational, said Timothy Burke and Jack Dickey in Deadspin.com. Star Notre Dame linebacker Manti Te'o led his team to the national championship game this season, despite suffering heartbreak when his beloved girlfriend, Lene Kikawa, died of leukemia on the very same day his grandmother passed away. The devout Mormon's tragic tale was burnished by glowing stories in Sports Illustrated and on ESPN and inspired tributes from across college football. The only problem, there was no Lene Kikawa. Te'o's cancer-stricken girlfriend never existed, but was a fictional persona allegedly created by Ronaya Tuisopo, a Hawaiian friend of Te'o's who pretended to be Kikua online and made his female cousin play Kikua on the telephone. The linebacker admitted last week that he had been conducting a love affair with Kikua since 2009 without ever meeting her, but claimed that until December he was ignorant of his friend's sick joke. "Why am I not convinced?" said Andrea Pizer in the New York Post. Te'o's mythic tale of playing with a broken heart to honor his dead girlfriend made him a figure of national admiration and helped him finish second in Heisman Trophy voting. His insistence that his friend was duping him all this time doesn't pass the smell test. Te'o's story does sound implausible, said Aisha Harris in Slate.com, but such hoaxes are increasingly common in a world where relationships are conducted primarily through texting, Twitter, and Facebook. The MTV show Catfish documents numerous instances where lonely, credulous people are duped into internet romances for months or years by people they've never met. Te'o may have ignored the bright red flags surrounding his imaginary relationship out of loneliness, insecurity, and perhaps a misplaced faith in the power of love. It's one thing to believe Te'o was duped, said Alan Barra in TheAtlantic.com, but it's quite another to accept that he was all so devoted to Kikua for 3 years without ever once meeting her. But even if he was in on the hoax, so what? There is no victim, no known crime. What's the moral of this twisted tale? Asked Andrew Leonard in Salon.com. Pundits are trying to blame the corruption of big-time college sports or social media and the Internet, but the Manti Te'o fake dead girlfriend story proves only one thing. Real people do stupid things, and so it goes. The second article under Talking Points is this, Roe at 40, who's winning the abortion battle? Happy birthday to Roe versus Wade, said Michael Mechanic in MotherJones.com, or at least to what's left of it. 40 years ago this week, the U.S. Supreme Court established in that controversial decision that women have a legal right to abortion. Ever since, however, pro-life groups and Republican lawmakers have been chipping away at Roe with public funding restrictions, mandatory sonograms, and other punitive measures. The result in 2013 is that almost 9 of 10 counties no longer have any doctor or clinic that performs abortions, and in conservative states like Kansas and Mississippi, Roe exists only in legal theory. This trend should not be applauded nor not condemned, said Marjorie Damensfeller in WashingtonExaminer.com. The tide on abortion is turning, and polls now show about half of all Americans identifying as pro-life. Polls notwithstanding, pro-lifers are not winning, said National Review in an editorial. The restrictions many states have adopted represent laudable resistance to an injustice, but can be overcome by driving to a city where abortion is freely available. With 56 million unborn children killed in the womb since Roe, another 3,400 every day, any suggestion that abortion is on the wane is obscene. While many people claim the pro-life label out of moral ambivalence, said Eric Zorn in ChicagoTribune.com, a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll this week found that 70% of respondents oppose Roe being overturned. As repulsive as abortion may be to many Americans, they are even more repulsed by the idea that the government could force a woman to remain pregnant against her will. What would happen if abortion became illegal again? Said Kate Manning in the New York Times. Women would do what women have done throughout history, choose abortion by their own hands. In this ghastly dark ages before Roe, women swallowed lye or strychnine, shot turpentine into their own wombs with syringes, punctured themselves with knitting needles, and threw themselves down flight of stairs, all in hopes of ending their pregnancies. An unwanted pregnancy can trigger such desperation that women will endure any risk and suffer any pain to regain control of their bodies and their destinies. There is no law that will end the practice of abortion, only laws that can protect a woman's right to choose it or not. Let's not be deluded about what will happen if the right is removed. And this related piece in the section called Poll Watch, 31% of Americans say they think abortion should always be legal, and 23% say it should be legal in most circumstances. 35% say it should be illegal with exceptions for rape, incest, or if the mother's life is in danger, and 9% say it should be illegal without any exceptions. That's from the Wall Street Journal, NBC News poll. Also on the Talking Points page, we see this section called Noted. President Obama's inaugural committee raised more than $53 million, mostly from 458 elite donors who gave $50,000 each. The big donors included officials at tech companies such as Google and Microsoft, and a roster of Hollywood celebrities, including directors Steven Spielberg, Ron Howard, and George Lucas, and actors Tom Hanks, Jamie Foxx, and Halle Berry. That's from the Boston Globe. At least 30% of the 255 generals, admirals, and other senior military commanders fired by the U.S. Armed Forces over the past 8 years lost their jobs because of sexual misconduct, including harassment, assaults, and adultery. That's from the Associated Press. Once again, over 30% of the 255 who were fired. Last year, for the first time, the percentage of U.S. women with tattoos, 23%, surpassed that of men at 19%, and that's from The New Yorker. Even though he issued 19 of them last week, President Obama has issued fewer executive orders per day than any other president since Grover Cleveland, And that's from NewYorkMagazine.com. In 2011, 663,032 people were arrested in the U.S. for marijuana possession, 128,328 more than were arrested for all violent crimes combined. And that's from HuffingtonPost.com. And finally, the Newtown, Connecticut school massacre and the talk of gun control it sparked has been a boon for gun makers and sellers. Buyers have been gobbling up assault weapons, large-capacity magazines, armor-piercing bullets, and other weaponry out of fear they will be banned. "My shelves are bare," said Virginia gun store owner Daniel Dover. This is from the Washington Post. And under Only in America, a New Jersey dog training school is offering classes in dog yoga, or dogga. As sitar music plays, dogs sit quietly while their owners do yoga over them and beside them, and then the owners stretch their pet's limbs into relaxing poses. Instructor Karen Stotzer said most dogs like the classes because they feel the calming energy. And finally, from Wit and Wisdom, most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. That's Abraham Lincoln, quoted in the Tampa Bay Times. And finally, I went to a bookstore and asked the saleswoman where the self-help section. She said if she told me, it would defeat the purpose. That's from Stephen Wright, quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The Week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long. Until next time.